This episode of Section D was first brobroadcast on Tuesday, the 1st of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Section D, in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Ahead on today's show, we'll be hopping around the globe, from Hyères on the French Riviera to the wilds of Norway, from the souks of Istanbul to the streets of London. Coming up on the programme, we sit down in London with arguably the most famous architect on the planet, Zaha Hadid.
But I don't think cities should be made of only sheds. I mean, they should have some nuances or some articulation, and that articulation needs effort on part of the designer and part of the builder to make a good building.
We drop in on the annual Hyères Festival of Fashion and Photography in France.
We love creativity, and here we found it the right place to meet people, to find ideas, and to meet also young designers.
And we talk Turkish design with Otaban, Istanbul's homegrown stars set to hit the world stage.
In my dream, and also Safar's dream, we want to do a modern art museum as an architect.
All that, plus we review a new exhibition looking at Norway's next generation of architectural talent, swing by a beautiful new furniture store in London's Clerkenwell district, and head south to Portugal to speak to Jorge Silva, a man on a mission to chart his nation's 20th century design heritage. That's all to come on this week's Section D. Stay tuned. Iraqi-born, London-based architect Zaha Hadid needs little introduction. She's one of the architecture world's larger-than-life characters, and her buildings cut as much of a presence on the built environment as Zaha herself does in an industry dominated by men. Last week, she was awarded the Jane Drew Prize for her outstanding contribution to the status of women in architecture. Our senior editor, Sophie Grove, sat down with her after the ceremony to talk about the extensive highs and lows of her career.
I wanted to ask you firstly about women. Today's been all about women. Do you think there still is a glass ceiling in architecture?
I think there, maybe it's not so high. I think there is still something. I don't think it's only because when men think badly of women. I think women, not all women, think well of themselves or of other women. So it has to come from within. You have to not support each other because it's a woman, but it's you know, I think it's still a problem.
And you've often in the past rejected the label of, you know, a female architect.
Yeah, I still do. But I think what has changed now, you see so many young architects really want assurance that they could survive. And I would accept to be a woman architect, between brackets, for that reason.
I wanted to ask you about your past and your upbringing in Baghdad, something that we've written about quite a lot in Monocle. Can you describe to me what it was like being brought up in liberal Baghdad and some of the architecture there that's inspired you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was in a school which, opposite me, they built the Ministry of Culture by Gio Ponti, and there were some really great projects done, and mostly housing, like in a very nice Garden City suburb, modernist houses, like case study houses in Los Angeles. They were not on the hill. Really beautiful. Yeah, I mean, Iraq was amazing. I mean, I traveled every summer, so it wasn't just Baghdad. But Baghdad was really very nice.
Do you think because there's been so much conflict there and political problems, some of the architecture has been overlooked and the architectural heritage?
Yeah, I'm sure they will repair it, but I mean, I heard this area that had beautiful houses, but it was really all dilapidated because many people left. It will take them some time to pull things together.
And you knew you wanted to be an architect from a very early age. Um, How did you go about the journey into architecture?
Well, I mean, I wanted to become an architect and that's all I wanted to be. And then I did math. And then I decided that I must go to London and do architecture. And that's what I did. I came here and then I went to the AA. But I don't know what it was that intrigued me or made me think I can do it.
Maybe you could tell me about some of the projects that you have in the Middle East.
No, we don't have too much work in the Middle East. I mean, we had three big projects in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, but nothing is happening to them. We're doing a very big project in Saudi Arabia, which is for a university, a kind of research institute. And we're doing the opera house in Jordan. We don't know where it's happening or not. We're doing another opera house or performance space in Morocco, possibly something in Algiers. We had two or three very projects in Egypt, but that has also stopped. We're doing something in Beirut, and in Iraq we're doing the central bank.
And can you tell me about some of your work that you've done in the UK? I mean, you've only recently been commissioned to work here.
We have hardly in any work. We've done the school, we've done the Maggie Centre, the Glasgow Museum, and now the Olympics.
Do you think that you were an outsider in architecture for many years?
I think I still am. Well, I think, partly is because most of the work which is done in the UK is corporate work. And I don't know, why do they think we can do corporate work? Because it's maybe not very repetitive or whatever. But it's an inaccurate reading.
Is that the only reason that you have for that? And do you think that your outsider status is giving you an edge, a kind of a fighting instinct?
I don't know what it is either. I don't know. It's very strange. There's so much development here and we're never asked to do anything.
And what are your plans for the future from now on? Are you looking to sort of conquer London, build something in London?
Well, I only would like to do something here because I've lived in the city and I have a kind of an idea about what should be built here. So I would like to do something, but I don't really mind. I mean, I think, I've been very lucky. I have so much work in other places. So it's okay. It'd be nice to do something here.
And you've dealt quite well with the disappointments in your career. I mean, you mentioned the Cardiff Opera House today. How have these experiences changed you?
I think they made us, in a way, a bit tougher. In a good way, I think Cardiff gave us a lot of experience into managing a very large team, a lot of consultants, our understanding of opera space, which we didn't, have before. So it has it had a positive thing as well, but it was negative for a while because we were heavily stigmatized. Although it wasn't our fault. After 5 years or 10 years, people forgot that it wasn't our fault. They know there was a problem. They assumed it was our fault, but it wasn't.
I'd like to ask you about your inspiration. You mentioned today being inspired by the Russian constructivists and Malevich early on. Is your work utopian in any way?
Well, I think it was. I mean, the whole point was that our ambition was to always build the theoretical project. And I think that's what people thought it was impossible to achieve, and we did, in parts. Yeah, the early ones were inspired by the Russian, but not. I think it was a great influence, but I don't think anymore. Well, the subtext, let's say, is now it's more about natural forces and nature and landscape and, But I think when it changed, it was kind of also liquid morphology and computing and so on.
And on the subject of morphology, some of your work is very difficult to pull off and it takes a long time and lots of high budgets. Do you think that in this era of austerity there is a place for your work?
Well, it's not necessarily more expensive than anything else. I think now with digitization you can accomplish all these things. It's slightly more complex than a flat, simple box, a shed. But I don't think cities should be made of only sheds. I mean, they should have have some nuances or some articulation. And that articulation needs effort on part of the designer and part of the builder to make a good building.
That was Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, with architect Zaha Hadid in London last week. And from the wet streets of London to the warmth and sunshine of the French Riviera. A sprawling modernist mansion in the south of France hosts one of the French fashion calendar's most creative events, the annual IER Festival of Fashion and Photography. Our reporter Hazel Pfeiffer discovered deck chairs, concerts and a wealth of young talent at the Villa Noël. Here's what she found.
Last weekend, a fashionable crowd descended on the chic Mediterranean town of IER for the annual Fashion and Photography Festival in the Villa Noël. Celebrating new talent, the festival selects 10 young designers and 10 young photographers from hundreds of entrants. The finalists exhibit their work and are entered for a number of prestigious awards. The festival is set in the modernist villa of Charles and Marie-Laure Noailles, which was built in 1925 at the top of steep, winding, cobbled streets overlooking the sweeping bay of Yer. Idyllic in the April sunshine, I wondered how the hectic world of fashion first came to this blissfully peaceful spot. Festival director Jean-Pierre Blanc told me how it all began.
I decided when I was at school, 27 years ago, to try to make a special moment to improve the relation between young designers and professional people. And we decided to do like a school project, and the town say, why not, you could try, and they give us a little bit of money. We do the first edition in 1986 during May, and it was a quite big success for people coming from Paris at this time. And the second edition was really, really incredible, with a lot of success too. And since 27 years, now it's gone, and we have always more and more people coming from all over the world, and it's really a special moment for fashion people and for photography people to exchange, to talk, to decide, to take pleasure, to have emotion around this festival.
The villa is a wonderfully confusing, split-level maze of showrooms, courtyards and exhibition spaces. Botanic gardens filled with birdsong surround the villa, where a conference space is tucked away amid leafy palms and sweetly scented jasmine trees. In a central garden, visitors lounge on deck chairs in the sunshine, admiring the view of the sparkling Mediterranean. It's the perfect location for a celebration of fashion, photography and art. But it's not all lounging about. Creative director Marcus Goli described the challenges of being on the fashion jury.
Aujourd'hui, il y a beaucoup de dichotomie.
Today, there are many dichotomies between creativity and reality, and the difficulty of adapting to the market that exists in fashion. However, we need to be demanding of creativity, because we can't accept designs that we have seen many times before, and we see a lot of designs. At the same time, we are tired, as there are a lot of fashion shows. I think that we have to be quite lenient to accept what's there, and at the same time be quite demanding, because we have seen some very strong things. It's a bit complicated, because if you do something very strong, very personal, in a reflection of fashion and design, it's difficult. It's complicated, but very interesting, as complex things are intriguing and mysterious.
On Saturday evening, we were swept off to a converted barn in a nearby nature reserve. Here, the 10 designers showcased their collections in a fashion show that was streamed live to the Palais de Tokyo in Paris. The standard was impressive and the collections diverse. Yoji Yamamoto led a fashion jury of old friends and collaborators like Paolo Versi and Olivia Salia to choose a winner for the Grand Prix de Jury Professionnel.
Elina Lehtinen, Siri Rahasaka and Tia Siren, Finland, Collection 1.
The three young Finnish designers presented a winning menswear collection of neon and multicoloured New Age streetwear with luminous shaggy jackets and Yeti-style trousers. Swarovski-encrusted rainbow-coloured baseball caps and trainers completed the neo club kid look. Although commercialism takes a backseat to creativity at IER, business is never far from the agenda. Big brand sponsors like Chloe, LVMH, Galerie Lafayette and Camper are all keen to tap into this resource of young talent. One of the young entrants, Canadian designer Stephen Tai, has won a week-long workshop at the Camper Studios in Mallorca. Felipe Salva from the cult Spanish shoe brand explains what keeps Camper coming back to Hier.
This is the third time we are involved in the fashion festival. In Camper, we love creativity, and here we found it the right place to meet people, to find ideas, and to meet also young designers, young upcoming talents.
There seems to be quite a holiday vibe here at the moment. Everybody feels quite relaxed.
Yes, but I'm used to, you know, our headquarters are in Mallorca, so we know about this Mediterranean atmosphere, relaxed and working, so it's not so different.
It seems the laid-back Mediterranean atmosphere adds to this celebration of burgeoning creativity. I get the feeling that this would not be the same event in the more conservative confines of Paris. But for all its casual charm, Hier is an important fixture on the European fashion calendar. Supported by the French Ministry for Culture and Education and the Committee for the Development and Promotion of French Clothing, this boutique festival is a sophisticated way of promoting the business of fashion in France. On Sunday afternoon, British band The Citizens played to a crowd on one of the grassy rooftop terraces. For the hordes of press, industry professionals and visitors, Hier is the ultimate mix of business with pleasure.
That was our reporter Hazel Pfeiffer at the Hier Festival of Fashion and Photography in France. Time for a short break, but stick around. We're off to Istanbul after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers, and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel, and we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Section D. Over the last 9 years, Istanbul-based architects Seyhan Özdemir and Sefer Kaglar, otherwise known as Ortaban, have been quietly updating traditional Turkish design with an altogether more contemporary feel. They've left their signature on a diverse range of projects, from architecture to interior design and furniture, in commercial and residential environments. Perhaps the most impressionable, though, has been the reinvention of the cafes and the social culture of their own city therein. Amy Gutman visited the Ortaban studio recently to hear more about the team's impact on Istanbul and their plans to move Turkish design beyond the borders of their homeland.
Ortaban, nasıl yardımcı olabilirim?
Welcome to the Ortaban studio.
Looking out onto the Bosphorus and the cobblestone streets of the trendy Galata neighborhood in Istanbul sits the open-plan exposed brick creative studio of Ortaban. Here, internationally recognized design duo Seyhan Özdemir and Sefer Kaglar lead a team of designers and architects. Seyhan invites me into her airy, high-ceilinged office to talk about what inspires them.
We were born here in Istanbul and grown up here. So we have so many things in our mind from the culture, from the past, from the history, from the daily life, people, everything.
We've both been in the business for more than 10 years with projects ranging from cinemas to airport lounges, with everything in between. Was it challenging to design a cinema? Because actually you're quite limited by the fact that you need a certain number of seats.
everybody needs to face the same way, and it needs to be sort of uniform, and there needs to be a screen, and there aren't a lot of lighting options to play with, I would imagine.
Cinema project is most challenging project for us because there are so many different people there. It's not only the project like restaurant, yes, A plus or B plus or coffee or fine dining or any other projects. Cinema project is for everybody. We try to find something from the daily life as a material, as a color, or some graphics and lights also.
So how did you solve the cinema problem? What colors did you choose? What kind of textiles did you choose? Give me some examples of some of the things that you chose to try to create a wider appeal, but yet keep a high design value.
Some movie theater, some cinema inspired from American culture, some of them from European culture. We try to make both, actually, which means we try to use some popular things like color, but also we try to use real material like old cinema in Europe. So we try to combine them.
So I'm picturing sort of a almost burlesque-y colored crimson red velvet.
Yeah.
In kind of a plush banquet seating.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. For example, we use yellow, but very warm yellow color, velvet curtain in the cinema. And actually, we put a red, warm red curtain in the movie theater, front of the scene.
It sounds like a wonderful throwback to what going to the movies used to be like. Let's talk a little bit about the coffee culture. The coffee culture, the cafe culture, I should say, in Istanbul is historic. Autobahn has been a very big part of the modern cafe culture here. How has that changed, too, because of Autobahn's influence?
When I was young, coffee shop means here in Istanbul, like just drink coffee or some drinks, some small snacks. That's all. And you don't want to stay long or whole day there. But when we start to work on our first coffee shop projects, and we thought that it has to be a social area, people should get together and not only eating or drinking, to meet, to talk with each other. So in our first project, coffee shop project, we put a big, long wooden table in the middle of the hall. In 1 year, people get used to it, to sit in the one long table, no one know each other, and meet there and became friends. And then coffee shops try to serve big meals. So coffee shop world became one of the most important social life.
I've come to the House Cafe in Istanbul. This is one of the cafes that Autobahn designed, and it served as a template for dozens of other cafes around Istanbul. I've come here to meet 30-year-old maritime lawyer Damla Atle.
Coffee culture in Turkey is like the thing, gathering of people anywhere, in the houses, and streets and everything. It's becoming more social places. It wasn't the same in the past. You couldn't spend all day there. It's not comfortable. But now it's different. But here you can have your food and you can have your parties if you want and everything. It's like the second house.
Back at the Autobahn studio, Sehun says they've created a demand for good design beyond the cafe, allowing them to develop exactly the kind of city they want to live in. Except there's just one thing missing.
In my dream, and also Safar's dream, we want to do a modern art museum as an architect.
If they can achieve that, the Autobahn team may well have created their dream city. For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Amy Gutman.
And staying in Turkey, it's time for a musical reprieve. This is Kamuran Akur with İkimiz Bir Fidimiz.
Yola çıkmış arıyorum, kaybettim aşkımı. yola çıkmış arıyorum. Kaybettim aşkımı, ne olur bana ümit verme. Seveceksen başkasını, ne olur bana ümit verme.
That was İkimiz Bir Fidimiz, which translates from Turkish as Together We Are a Tree by Kamuran Akur. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Back on home soil, we were thrilled to learn last week of a new store opening in London's Clerkenwell district. Forest is an emporium selling imported mid-century Scandinavian furniture. Nothing groundbreaking there. But the mission of owner Ava Koppel is to bring new life to the vintage collections with a series of complementary collaborative exhibitions and projects. First up, a range of furniture reupholstered with the beautiful graphic fabrics of textile designer Tamazin Gamble. Monocle's David Michon dropped in to hear all about it.
I'm Ava, I'm 25 years old, I'm from Amsterdam. I just opened a shop 2 weeks ago on Clerkenwell Road, selling mid-century Scandinavian furniture. I studied fashion management at LCF and therefore moved to London about 4 years ago. And before this, I did two pop-up shops, one just down the road on Clerkenwell and one in Hampstead. And they went really well, so that's why I kind of, made a permanent shop my own.
Why kind of mid-century Scandinavian furniture?
Well, studying fashion, I always loved Scandinavian brands, fashion brands, and I happened to come across some family friends who were mid-century furniture dealers, and I kind of picked out all the Scandinavian designers. And studying PR marketing, I thought that would be quite interesting to kind of have a pop-up shop and kind of show more about the designers, the background, the history of Scandinavian furniture, and that went really well, and it kind of took off from there.
And were the pop-up shops very successful? Did you find, what was the response that you got from those experiences?
Yeah, the one on Clerkenwell Road, I really loved it because there are so many designers and architects around here that really appreciate, the forms and the aesthetic. The one in Hampstead was quite different. Different people, maybe not so appreciative of the design, and that's why I kind of knew that I wanted to move back to Clerkenwell. And there was just a lot of creativity here.
Do you find most of your pieces here in London, or do you kind of...
No, I don't buy anything in the UK, because I think that if people really want to buy, stuff that is available in the UK, they can just go to markets, and I think that's a, added value that I can give them. So I source in Denmark, in the Netherlands, in Sweden, Germany, and... if people would see a piece on eBay and then a week later see it in my shop, I think that would be a horrible feeling, and I wouldn't want that, to happen to me. So I'm quite proud that I get everything from abroad, and it kind of brings difficulties when it comes to drivers and, getting stuff over here in one piece. But, that's part of the fun as well. It's a challenge.
And how do you think people have reacted here in Clerkenwell to your shop? Has there, in the past 2 weeks, have a lot of people stopped by?
They have. They've been actually really sweet and come in and congratulate me with the space and just said that it's amazing what I'm doing. So that was really, really nice because I worked really hard doing the place up for about 2 months. So to get that kind of feedback was a big relief. And also, I know it felt really good. And they were happy that a shop opened kind of in the neighbourhood.
And do you think there, in terms of design retail in London, is it quite strong, or do you feel like you're offering something really different, or you're participating in a movement that's already quite, deep-rooted?
That's difficult. I'd like to offer something different and something quite personal. Everything in here is stuff that I absolutely love and adore and want to have myself. I think a lot of people are doing, very interesting things, a lot of independence. I think it's a great time for independence because we also kind of team together and, collaborate, like what I'm doing with the print designer, Tamazin Gamble. I think, with the recession and everything, you kind of need to become more creative to be able to survive, which is, it's exciting as well. It's a challenge and I like it.
And London is kind of no stranger to mid-century Scandinavian furniture shops. There's a handful of quite good ones in the city. So, you mentioned Tamazin, who's also here with us, who's a print designer. And is that kind of your edge? Is that kind of how you refresh the concept of mid-century furniture?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's quite selfish because I love mid-century furniture, but I also like a challenge. So that's why I aim to collaborate with not only print designers, but photographers. You know, I have small exhibitions, kind of keep it very interesting for myself as well and for my customers, so they can come in, you know, every month or so and see something very different from what they saw before.
Maybe it's time to kind of turn to Tamsin and ask, how did you kind of get involved in this collaboration and you know, what are you kind of gaining from it as well?
Well, I've worked with Ava for about 4 years now in different forms. And for me, it was just a really great challenge because I'm also a big fan of mid-century Scandinavian furniture. But for me, it was about taking something that's an old classic and reinventing it and turning it into something that was a modern classic. And my design's very much about keeping things timeless so that there's a very kind of new, edgy aesthetic, but it's not something that will date. And I think that's where my prints and this furniture work so well together, because the prints don't really have a specific trend or a specific aesthetic. They're hopefully very timeless, as the furniture is.
And for the people who kind of, you know, aren't able to see your prints, can you maybe just describe, you know, what they're like and what your approach is in designing them?
Mm-hmm. All my designs are very graphic based. It's all about shapes and colours interacting together. It's very bold and graphic, and the colours aren't designed to be in a specific season. They're very trans-seasonal.
And, you know, these prints that are on the furniture now, are they something you would have designed anyway, or did you design them kind of with the furniture in mind?
Ava and I worked really closely, actually, and we met from the beginning, and Ava showed me pictures of all the different furnitures, so I very much had in mind what I was designing for. So bearing that in mind, I chose very specific colourways, and we had loads and loads of meetings where we met up at different stages during the design process. And the way I work is design about 15 different prints and do lots of different colourways and then very much whittle it down, and then we chose which prints would go with which pieces. So, you know, with every piece, it's very much tailor-made. The print is tailor-made to the piece of furniture that you get.
You know, given that, you know, you're really interested in the history of the furniture, is it important for you that the fabrics are all, you know, hand-printed and, that, you know, the upholstery is all done here in London or the UK? You know, is it important to kind of keep up a rich story for the furniture when you're kind of adding something new to it?
Yeah, no, definitely. It's very added value. And I mean, because I worked for Tamsin for quite a while, every single thing she does, she works really hard to get, you know, the right suppliers, the right way to do it, to make it. And I mean, checking as well. You know, people can tell you that, you know, it's done or made in a certain way, but you have to double check it and see if it is actually true what they say and do. So I've always loved what she's done. All her prints are amazing as well. So I think it is a great addition. And, you know, with spring, a lot of my furniture is kind of neutrals and darker colors. So I think for the spring, it's amazing to have these kind of colors popping up in the cushions or in the whole kind of upholstered furniture pieces.
That was David Michon talking to owner Ava Koppel and textile designer Tamsin Gamble at the new store Forest in London's Clerkenwell. We're off to Portugal now, where a series of books devoted to 20th century Portuguese designers recently celebrated the launch of its third tome. Jorge Silva, one of the most respected designers in the country, is the man behind the project. He explained to Monocle's Saima Tariq the importance of a project that promotes his current rivals, as well as past greats, all in the name of maintaining his nation's visual heritage.
There are several people mulling around one table piled with books at a smart store in Lisbon's Príncipe Real district. These unassuming volumes are deceptive. Though only showcasing the work of one designer, they are part of an historical series of editions that for the first time celebrates 20th century Portuguese design. The creative force behind the collection, entitled Coleção D, is respected editorial designer Jorge Silva. His concept was simple: to curate Portuguese design heritage in a wide variety of disciplines from fashion illustration to museum posters into the format of a user-friendly book series that are as beautiful as they are affordable.
It's a not expensive collection of books. It is very important today because in Portugal we like to talk about design and art with big books, coffee table books. is a very important idea. The most important is the memory about the past. Today in the Ike schools, it's very difficult to the teachers to talk and explain about the old generations of designers. A self-conscious of design in Portugal is after the 70s. It's very young. The teach of design in Portugal is about the work, practical work, with the ateliers, studios, and the companies in the market, but about the story, to analyze the past, is we have no critical mass to do it. It is a problem I found every day, every year in the schools, when I go to speak about art direction or illustration, or simply to show the portfolio of silver designers.
A 60-year dictatorship and a peripheral position on the edge of Europe, according to Silva, meant Portugal has always looked outwards for visual reference, if at all. His need to create an ocular narrative that was ownable in a series of books means that he even had to include some of his own competitors, such as Pedro Falcão, subject of the current and third edition.
I know one thing now. People like more old designers. It's more fashionable, retro, etc. But it is important to this collection to show contemporary designers. The first number of this collection is about one of the most fantastic design studios in Portugal today, now. The second number is about a old and classic and fantastic designer, Vitor Paula. Pedro Falcão, it's a fantastic designer, but in some competitions I am, and him too. This book is a fantastic promotion of a rival, a competitor. It's crazy. I have a menu of 56 designers for 80 or 9 years to publish books. I think the Portuguese design is a world design.
Each 128-page book serves as a visual tract, around 6 by 7 inches in size. Individually, they are image-heavy tomes covering everything from revolutionary posters and vintage adverts to café signs and objets d'art. I asked George Silva about his own design past.
I have deeply involved in the revolution. Not like politic, but like graphic. The designer in the last years of 70s, I worked like every designers in the world. I used photography in black and white, very aggressive, and the typography. I'm embarrassed about the typography choices in the 70s, but. Now, I use today the same, like Futura, like Avant-Garde, and Helvetica now. I'm 54 years old. I worked in many things, in many newspapers and magazines, typographies. I have too much love in typography, in illustration. In all my life, all my design or graphic design life, I like to work with the meaning of the words, not the shape of the words.
Coleção D's new third edition is the first published monograph for Pedro Falcão, a young designer who has worked with Portuguese cultural institutions and some of the best museums and artists. He told me how he felt about being part of such a prestigious project.
When I start to work with artists, I have to be a designer that is behind them. I cannot put myself in the front of them. So I think this is the main thing of my work. It's simplicity and powerful. And this collection is very good because George is doing an investigation in the older designers, which is something that is not in the internet. So George talked to me about older designers that I don't know. I know one book or one poster, but I don't know all the work. And the it's very interesting because George said to me that now he's getting more close to the designers, understand more the work, and that approach is very good to build a new generation and that for the generation to understand better the past to build the future.
That was Simon Tarek, Our Lady in Portugal, with designer and author Georgie Silva. Time for a quick break. But stick around, we're talking Norwegian architecture after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced current affairs hour at midday London time. We review the American front pages fresh off the press, check in on the stories unfolding in Europe, and round up the events at the end of the day in Asia.
Who is the true conservative? This is the question voters and primaries are going to have to be asking themselves.
Wake up in New York to The Briefing, live every weekday at midday London time.
Welcome back to Section D. Norwegian architecture is a field most people associate with sturdy wood, finely crafted timber, and polished structures in beech or oak. But a new exhibition at the Royal Institute of British Architects in London goes beyond just focusing on the wood and lets the viewer explore the deeper, ongoing relationship between Norwegian architecture and nature. We send our reporter, Thea Ørdal, who just happens to be Norwegian herself, to investigate further.
Reiulf Ramstad Architects and Jensen and Skodwin Architects are two of the most high-profile and innovative practices based in Norway. The exhibition Contemporary Norwegian Architecture at the RIBA explores their work through elaborate models and images. The show emphasizes on rural constructions, most notably through the National Tourist Route Scheme. The National Tourist Routes are carefully selected routes that offer a picturesque trip and tourist-friendly infrastructure, such as rest stops and viewpoints, all designed by some of the top architecture offices in Norway. A carefully curated selection of tourist route projects are displayed by each practice at the RIBA. A range of other buildings, including housing and public works, are also included in the exhibition. Both offices have been involved in dual exhibitions earlier, and Ramstad explains how their first collaborative exhibition came to London.
This is a part of a traveling exhibition that's been going around for us in Europe for more than 1 year. One day, Jan Olav and I were in the office of the Foreign Department in Norway, and then we were asked if we were interested to join our forces together and present ourselves in this special occasion.
Rural architecture is demanding work, and one of the main challenges is obviously Norway's diverse topography. Here, Skodwin talks about how his office handles the forces of nature.
There is a lot of topography in Norway. There is a lot of landscape, and you have to deal with it all the time. And I like to think that Norwegian architects, or at least many Norwegian architects, have developed a particular skill in dealing with difficult topographies. Because what we find, what our experience tells us, is that it's much easier to change the building than to change the landscape. So this strategy of adaptation to the landscape, as opposed to actually leveling out for a flat site, is something that's quite common, and which can be developed as a very fine-tuned skill. And when you're dealing with landscape and topography, and it's very difficult to find a good way to merge the construction, the structure, which is very predictable, and the topography, which is very unpredictable, which has a lot of measurements and different positions. So what we at least try to do is to develop some kind of strategy that will allow us to do that without knowing everything about every position on the site, but rather to find some kind of way to land the building gracefully without knowing all that information.
Both Ramstad and Skodwin have worked with rural and urban projects, and I asked Ramstad if he had any preferences between the two.
My attitude, every project is a possibility to do something, a work which contains the best solution for that particular site. And for that matter, for me, it doesn't matter if you're like in a very beautiful natural landscape or you're like in an urban situation. The methods of trying to find concepts that do contain like sustainable values and at the same time obtain as much as possible with as little as possible, it has something to do that actually, like also like working out in natural landscapes, it's a part of the discussion actually. Maybe the landscape, it's very old, it's not been touched. And maybe the buildings are there for some time and maybe they will some sort of disappear in the future. So it's also the work of an architect to evaluate the situation and not only think of the building, but actually the landscape you're working in. And for that matter, I do believe that sometimes the solutions even don't look like buildings. So architecture can come out in very many different ways, maybe part of like built landscape and sometimes like conventional houses.
The idea of built landscapes is integral in Norwegian architecture, as the architect has to be considerate of both the structure itself and the landscape surrounding it. Skodvin elaborates a bit on a specific project he did out in the murky forest of Norway.
It's just a very, very simple little project, and it was actually one of the first pilots for the National Tourist Roads project. It was a lay-by in a very beautiful pine forest, and the idea was to bring the cars into that forest and to let them drive to some location where you could get out of your car and sit down and have a rest without taking down any of the trees. And the strategy was to use an old dried-out riverbed and fill it with gravel so that you would get a drivable surface. And what was interesting about that project was that it was actually drawn in full scale on site, delineating the outline of the filling with sticks in the terrain. And then only afterwards, we measured it and made a plan. So it was a project that was made without a drawing, but it was rather developed as a kind of principle or an architectural idea and an instruction. But it didn't get its shape until it was actually executed. And then if you did it in a different place, the geometry of the project would be different. So that was very interesting for us because, you know, we realized that the architectural idea doesn't necessarily need to be connected to a particular form or shape.
The status of Norwegian architecture is undoubtedly rising, and both Skodvin and Ramstad feel that it's a good time to be in the business of buildings and the creation of landscapes.
I think one of the advantages Norway has is that it's a very peripheral country. It's sort of on the periphery of everything. And I have a theory that due to that, we've avoided some of these plagues of architectural isms that have sort of scourged the European continent and the Americas. And you have all these new isms and everything transforms, everything reconfigures every time you have this new trend. And to a certain extent, we've avoided that, which means that there is a kind of architectural presence which has a much longer continuity, even with our relatively short modern history. So, I mean, perhaps that gives a slightly different bias or a slightly different identity, which sets it apart from a lot of the other stuff that's going on and gives it a kind of identity or character.
I don't particularly myself feel like a typical Norwegian architect, but I do think what is quite interesting, like working with this kind of interaction between architecture and landscape in these kind of questions, you have to work with very fine scale tools. And I do believe that like the last two decades of architecture has been very aggressive on global scale. You can see like star architects, buildings that are more logos that could have been placed anywhere. And especially like going to Asia, you see coming to a city like Beijing, you can see the buildings could be anywhere actually. And I do actually think this is a global process that people some sort of are longing back to a landscape which maybe was there once or even is still there. And so for that, I do believe that this kind of skill talking about how could a place be developed with architecture and not transform completely, it's quite interesting because it talks about actually how all kinds of human people have a a need to feel identity. I don't think it's a matter of national culture. I think it's actually a tendency in the global culture.
For Monocle, in London, I'm Thea Udall.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be visiting the studio of Shepard Fairey, one of the world's more famous graphic designers, following the meteoric success of his Obama Hope poster. We'll also be hearing about Arne Jacobsen's design legacy at St. Catherine's College in Oxford. And, tracing our steps even further back through 20th century design history, we'll be looking at the Barbican's landmark Bauhaus exhibition too. So be sure to tune in then. This week's show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.